Welcome to the Social Bamboo Podcast. I am joined by Jordan West of the Secrets to Scaling Your E-Commerce Brand Podcast. How's it going today, Jordan?
Hey, it's good, Derek. Thanks for having me on here.
Absolutely, man. I'm excited to always get e-commerce people on. The last e-com person we had on was Peter Peru. I don't know if you know him.
I do not know Peter.
Big on YouTube. He's on a couple weeks ago, or actually, we're going on a couple months, so it's been a little bit since we've had some e-commerce info, so really excited to have you on, man. Tell me a little bit just about yourself, some of your brand, your podcast. Just introduce yourself before I get into the good stuff.
Yeah, totally. So my name is Jordan West, from beautiful Canada, British Columbia. I look out from my office here and I see the States. So I'm that close. I am a multi-brand owner. As of June 1st, we're going to own 5 brands, as well as our marketing agency that helps e-commerce brands really grow. My passion is everything e-commerce. It's kind of funny because, you know, nowadays everything is e-commerce, right? If you're selling a product, and you're not selling online, you're probably not doing a great job and you're probably not doing all the things that you could be doing to actually reach your audience.
There really is so many things that you can be doing, and you own 5 brands now, you said, so I'm sure you've, got a lot of experience here. Are these in really different markets, or how much overlap is there?
Yeah, there's sort of 2 core markets that we're going after right now. And there is a little bit of overlap with both of them. So one is in the outdoor space. So we really love the outdoor space. One of our brands, that we own, Keep Nature Wild, we are committed to picking up a pound of trash, for every item that we sell. And so we're well beyond that right now as far as the trash picking up. But the outdoors really matter to us. I am out mountain biking probably 5 days a week. So I love the trails. I love seeing them clean. And then we love to be able to serve our customers in that space, however we can. So, one of our brands is a subscription box, in that category in the outdoor space. And then, the other big niche that we serve are moms. So we started with a baby clothing company in 2014, 2015. And that has, spiraled into a women's clothing brand, mainly focused on serving moms, and then also a pajama brand.
So tell me, when you were choosing these niches, were you choosing it based off of the opportunities that you saw, or because you were passionate about these markets?
Yeah, I mean, definitely both, right? So our baby clothing brand, Little and Lively, started when we started to have kids, and we realized that there were certain items that we wanted that we couldn't actually get. So one of them was, you know, we were starting cloth diapering, and we couldn't find leggings that would go over top of cloth diapers. And so my wife was a fashion designer, and she's like, oh, this is a pretty easy pattern to make. So she made that. That just turned into more and more, you know, gaps that she was seeing out there in the market. And we created a clothing brand around that. And so we manufacture everything, in British Columbia, which is really unique and difficult to do. But at the same time, really rewarding for those 3 brands that were actually able to do that here in Canada.
And this is the first brand?
Yeah. So everything sort of grew from that. So, you know, we grew that brand over the years, to what it is now. It will be probably close to 8 figures, this next year, just to sort of give you an idea of size. And then from there, people would often ask, I was always really involved in the marketing. People would often ask, you know, like, how do you grow stores? And so I would go in and just do free consulting for them. I just loved it so much. It was just one of those things that I really loved doing for people. And then eventually people were like, hey, can you just run our ads for us and, you know, help us with our email and all that? And I'm like, sure. Like, I guess I'll charge you like, I don't know, $500 a month to do it. I didn't know. And this is a few years. Quite a few years ago now. So that started Mindful Marketing, our agency. And at the time, you know, anybody who had come in the door, it was just like, didn't really matter who it was. We would take them on. Now we're very specific about who we serve, in the e-commerce space. So that's sort of how that all evolved. It's been a lot of, you know, now that I'm talking to you about this, I'm like, man, there's a lot of growth and a lot of like different areas that we've been in.
It's so funny. I think a lot of people have similar entrepreneurship stories where wherever you started somewhere, and then the next business idea, you didn't plan on it. It just kind of came based off of your customers bringing it up or people asking for it. you know, just kind of you roll with the punches as you go here. And I'm sure you didn't have the vision of having all five of these brands right when you started the first one, right? They kind of just kept making sense as you went.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, when we started our clothing brand, I had just gone through a near bankruptcy owning a Mexican restaurant. So that was my first, you know, foray into business, was owning this restaurant and just struggling. It's crazy. I think the best year we did in sales, it was double. It was more than double what we did when we started, but it was still like, I think it was like $350,000 in sales that year, which is still losing a lot of money. Like, there's just not enough money to go around to cover all the costs when you're doing that low
sales. Was it a franchise?
It was a franchise. It was a Taco Del Mar restaurant. And so there's just so many. I would just recommend to people with an entrepreneurial spirit, franchises aren't necessarily always the best thing to get into, right? You're paying 12% off the top, back to the franchisor. Unless you really can't put systems together and create a brand, I just don't recommend it. Like, I don't know if I call it a mistake, but there was definitely, I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I did it, but I always recommend to people, if you're going to be an entrepreneur, a true entrepreneur, you got to start your own thing. You got to start your own brand or buy a brand. I mean, that's what we're doing right now. Like, I've got lined up after these two acquisitions that we're in the middle of. I've got two more after that because they just make so much sense to find a brand that's already doing great things. And then see if you can take it to the next level.
Now, is that something you'd recommend for someone's first business, or are you doing that because you already know what you touch is going to be gold? Once, like, you can look at a business and say, I know that based off of these numbers, your products, my expertise, I can come in and grow this company. You
totally
can say that based off of experience. Do you think people should look at buying a business as their first thing, or is this more like a good move for the second or third?
I think it's a better move for the second or third, but building a brand and building a business is very difficult, right? The building portion is incredibly difficult. Getting to seven figures, right? I think that's the big mark, right? Getting into that $1 million revenue range, which is really where you can then start to build a team, right? Before that, it's a lot more difficult to build a team, in e-commerce. When you're in that sort of, like, you know, mid six figure kind of range, there's not a lot to go around at that point. So that's why I really love picking up these businesses that are hitting those, you know, low seven figure sort of marks, because you can have a great team and still be able to pay your bills. And cash flow at the end of the day is really what is going to kill you. So if you don't have that cash flow, it's going to be a lot more difficult.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
I've heard of the website, I think it's called EmpireFlippers.com.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Is that where you're looking for businesses?
No, I'm not. No, I'm a networker.
Okay.
I am a networker. So if you want to get the best businesses aren't for sale, right? The best businesses that you're going to buy are never for sale.
Mm.
So being able to build up your network and build up your authority in the space and know that when somebody wants to potentially sell, in that space, that they know who to go to. That is really what I'm after. Occasionally, like I'm actually talking with an acquisition right now from Flippa, which is another one of those kinds of websites. But immediately get them off the platform. I don't want to deal with those platforms. I want to be able to negotiate, those deals myself, and the terms of those deals, right?
Do they take a percentage?
I believe that they take a percentage off of the buyer side, not off the,
okay.
Or sorry, off the seller side, not the buyer side.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. Still, like, that's a huge purchase. So. Even a few percent.
It's true. It's true. And it can work out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It can work out so much better for the seller to just go straight through, a buyer. But lots of the people who are buying on those sites aren't sophisticated buyers, right? They might go on there and look and be like, ah, that looks like a good business, but they don't really understand. Like for us now at the stage that we're at, there's so many economies of scale, that we're able to take advantage of. And that's really important. When we look at a balance sheet and we're like, oh, sweet, we can cut that, we can cut that, and just add them in or tuck them under.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm certainly going to be diving into your ad strategies here in a sec. Let's go back to what you were saying about that first company though. I want to ask a question about that before I move on. You said your wife was designing these baby clothes, or what were these items?
Yeah. So, and she still does. So she was the fashion designer for all of our clothing. So instead of, you know, finding a third party manufacturer who already has designs, she actually just created all of the designs, and she still does. That's her main role at the company, is in that overarching design role.
So I feel like a lot of people, they want to start a brand and they don't want to just drop ship whatever's on Alibaba. They want to have some kind of creative component to it like that. Did you guys do like print on demand with this? Did you do Amazon FBA, or what's the structure so that you were able to start this company as your first move and still be able to build your own designs?
Yeah, I mean, great question. So even all of our clothing were still like she's actually designing, right? So like all of the, like this is one of our shirts that we have. All of it is to our specific specifications. If I were starting out in this space, I would most likely find a supplier of people who are already making clothing. I would not go print on demand. Absolutely not. There are no margins in print on demand now. That was a ship that I think has sailed for about 3 or 4 years now, where the margins are just not there. You cannot acquire customers on Facebook, that are going to stick around and have that lifetime value with print on demand. I think there's some print on demand that works. I've got people in my mastermind who are doing incredible with print on demand, but they've created relationships that are really deep in print on demand. And that's more like in the portrait print on demand space.
Are you finding the ones who are doing well in print on demand have some kind of customization factor to their products where,
Exactly. If you can go customize print on demand, you are absolutely golden. We've got some clients in that space as well at the agency, that are in that print on demand customized. But they do it, all of them do it in house as well. There is a point where it just makes a lot of sense to move in house. Once you're at about $1 million in revenue a year, there's just no reason to be paying all of that to somebody else. Cause your margins are so thin, like restaurant margins, you know?
E-commerce does have thin margins is probably the biggest thing that people battle with, because you can do $100,000 in sales in a year and still walk away with pretty much nothing, you know, if you can't get your profit margins good. And a lot of people lose that when they try to do Facebook ads, I feel like, or just some kind of advertising, because their numbers look good on the fixed costs, right? But the variable cost of marketing is the thing that they just can't control to get to a rate where they're getting profitable sales consistently.
That's definitely something we see for sure, right? And especially Amazon people moving over. That's the biggest thing, right? Is people are used to Amazon customers and Amazon feeding them all of the customers. And that is not the way that it is when you're building a brand off of Amazon. And I don't build brands on Amazon. I'm not that person. I love to build brands off of Amazon, own the customers, but man, is it way more expensive, right? At first.
Do you list them on Amazon later?
We don't. None of our brands are on Amazon.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
And that's not something I'm not against that at all. It's just, with all the brands that we have so far, demand, has been high enough off of Amazon that we're okay not being on there right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's maybe some things that would make you consider moving some stuff to an Amazon warehouse or?
Absolutely. I mean, there's some ways that I think Amazon can work really, really well, especially for top of funnel acquisition, but I wouldn't put my entire line on Amazon and ship it down to the warehouses. I would do two or three specific products that we know are our best sellers specifically for Amazon. That way you're not reliant on Amazon for all of your income, because there will be a day when, you know, whoever, I was going to say Jeff Bezos, but he's not even the CEO anymore. When they change something, right? And you don't own them, right? Kind of similar to like what's happened with Facebook ads.
You know about the new CEO, by the way?
I don't. I know he's been in the company for a long time.
Okay.
Or they've been in the company for a long time. Yeah. I've barely read anything about it. It doesn't really apply too much to my life. So
If you're not on Amazon, yeah, Bezos can be ruthless with his business decisions sometimes. If you look at the affiliate pay scale over time and just the fees increasing, so it's only getting harder over there, it seems like. What is your take on someone who wants to get started on e-commerce at this point? Like you said, print-on-demand maybe 3-4 years ago was probably one of the easiest ways to get started. You can make your own designs. It's drop shipped. A lot of times it's even shipping from the United States. So good shipping times. You know, drop shipping has obviously been big for a long time. Amazon FBA. Like, what is your kind of structure for someone getting started, and what are like the next major steps for their business?
Yeah. So first things first, I'd try and figure out what niche you're trying to serve, right? The best place to look at is in the mirror. Right. So if you have no idea what you're going to sell, look in the mirror first, right? And figure out what you want and the needs that you have. Amazon is actually a great place to go do research for that, right? Find products that you're buying, read the reviews, figure out what they're missing and create that product, right? There, that is the first place that I would go. And then I'd make sure that you've got your product to about 90% before you start to enter the market, right? So serve that niche. And that's why I say look in the mirror, because you know yourself, right? Or hopefully you have some idea of yourself, and start to serve that person. And that's where you're going to start to see, a lot of growth, right? Because you know how to talk to that person. So building up a brand, I think, is really, really important. If you're not interested in building a brand, just go to Amazon. Just go do FBA on Amazon, right? Create a product, ship it to the warehouses and get them to sell it for you. Do some Amazon PPC. That's the easiest way. If you're just in it just to make a bit of cash, that's what I would do. But if you really want to make an impact and build a brand and change people's lives, have employees, you know, really build something, that is where I would start, is building a brand. But you have to know your customer to do that.
Are they doing that? So would you recommend they start it? Let's say they have no website experience. So maybe Shopify is where they start that brand.
Absolutely. Do not go anywhere but Shopify. That is not, there's no option,
WordPress. Yeah. I have so much experience with WordPress. I hate it. I can't do anything. Every time I tweak anything, it wrecks the rest of my website. Yeah. I'm just done with it. I like ClickFunnels too. Totally. Shopify is great for getting started.
Yeah. ClickFunnels awesome if you're going to be running just one product. Again, I'd probably run ClickFunnels through Shopify though, right? Use their integration and run it through Shopify, because there will be a point where you want everything centralized and you want that central place of truth, and Shopify can be that for you.
So you still use Shopify for all five of your brands?
So one of them, unfortunately, is on a custom platform, custom subscription platform. And so that one, we are not able to move off for 3 years with our contract. So that's an unfortunate thing. But there are workarounds. So we're actually working around with, putting things through Shopify being our source of truth. Because that particular brand actually does have a really good future on Amazon with the products that they've already created that we're purchasing the IP for.
Okay. So let's say that they started their brand on Shopify. They got their first 10 products listed. Are you telling them usually look for, so they're doing drop shipping. Okay.
Okay.
Are they going to build an audience organically first, or do you usually go right to paid ads just so you can get data quicker and test your ideas? What's your product launch for an untested product?
Yeah. I mean, if it's untested, I would definitely start with building out both, right? So start to build that organic audience. Send those products to as many people as you can that are going to give you good, honest reviews. I mean, you can send them to your parents. I don't know if you're going to get an honest review from them, but as many people as you can to get reviews of the product that you can then use in your advertising as well, right? Make sure your branding is tight, right? Your branding needs to be really tight, especially for a new product that nobody knows anything about. That is really where I would start. And then just, if you're going to be drop shipping, start testing multiple products. I don't like drop shipping. I like to be in control of the products that I sell. And I like them to be mine, not ones that can be ripped off, you know, the next day. So like we had one of our lead account managers here, at Mindful Marketing, our agency. He actually ended up working with us because he had an incredibly thriving drop shipping business, that overnight was ripped off by somebody They got the exact same supplier. They did everything on the website, and they just outbid them in search and outbid them in Facebook, and it just ended up tanking, right? If they own the product and they own the brand, that will not happen, right? You then have the control, and I love to be in control of my destiny. You know, like the happiest people in the world take the most responsibility for themselves, right? And for their actions and anything that happens around them. And I want to be a happy person, and dropshipping does not allow me to do that.
Got it. Okay. So I should have asked there. So they're not setting up with dropshipping. The first step you recommend is buying a few thousand, or, you know, however much quantity they can afford, just a basic, small batch of inventory and selling.
Whatever the smallest MOQ that you can get, minimum order quantity from a factory.
Yeah.
Do that, right? Test that product. Okay. And if you sell out of 100, if that's the MOQ and you sell out of 100, awesome. Order 1,000 more, right? Read Shoe Dog and see how Phil Knight did it as he was growing his business like that, right? There is a lot of expensive money out there that you can get to grow fast. But don't necessarily always take it, right? If you don't know what you're doing, knowing your numbers is so important at the beginning, right? You can sell anyone can sell $1 million worth of clothing or whatever. But if you're not profitable on that and your cash flow statement isn't going up, you've got a problem, right? There's a problem there. So knowing your basics first is really, really important before you start scaling that up, right? We talk about scaling all the time on our podcast, Secrets of Scaling Your E-commerce Brand. But there is good scaling and there's bad scaling, right? Bad scaling is unprofitable scaling. It's scaling just for the sake of revenue, right? And I'm trying to think what I want to call it. Like, I've got a certain term for it that I don't want to say on the podcast, but it's really just a competition, right? You're like, oh, cool. I've got 40 employees, right? Like, oh, that makes me feel so good. And like, you tell your friends, but it doesn't actually matter unless you're profitable, right? At the end of the day, if you're not profitable, your business isn't going to grow. You can't hire more people. You can't hire quality talent. You can't give your employees benefits. All of those things, right, that you really want to do to change people's lives and the trajectory of their lives.
So with e-commerce, I think when people do their numbers, especially when they're new, there's just a lot of numbers that they forget to account for is a lot of times why the numbers don't end up working well. Can you give me some guidelines of when you're looking online for a new product to source? What might be some numbers that the average person isn't considering that you're taking into account for the long-term profitability of that product?
Yeah, so fulfillment costs, right? Are you going to fulfill it? Is a third party going to fulfill it? That ends up being a huge cost in the end, right? Do you have to have employees to fulfill it? Lots of people, they just take the product cost, right? Oh, good, my product cost is 25%. Generally, that's a great rule of thumb, right? Is 4x whatever your product is. That's, then you can have keystone pricing with wholesalers. So you just double that. But it needs to be even better than that, right? Because you need to take into account your lease. You need to take into account Shopify. When you start to scale, you might need to move to Shopify Plus, which ends up being $2,000 US. You know, are there, shipping costs that you're maybe not seeing, right? Are there import costs that you're not seeing? There's all of these different things, bank fees, right? Those add up in the end. You know, the 2.5% that, your payment provider is going to take. There's all of those that you need to add in before you really figure out when you can be profitable. And you need to leave, like, the aim, right, is to leave that 20 to 25% over as profit. That's always our goal with everything that we do.
So that 4X rule you're looking at is just maybe the number you're going off of when you're just doing your general research. You're kind of asking, can I sell this product for 4 times what it's listed at?
Exactly. So 4x my raw cost is what I'm always looking at, right?
Okay.
So 25%. And then that allows for healthy margins and staffing and all of that. That's a really good rule of thumb, especially if you're going to go into wholesale, which again, if you're building a brand, I highly recommend you go into wholesale. You know, people, it's funny. We've had this huge swing, right? It used to be all being in retail and wholesale. And then now you see these brands that are like, no, we're only going to sell online, right? I disagree with both. Like, you need to have a hybrid. If you're going to build a real brand, you need to have a hybrid model of both of these and sell into stores, because that's a huge marketing channel, right? We do post-purchase surveys, and I believe it's between 13 and 15% of our customers find us because they went into a store. So first of all, I'm making a small margin on those stores that we're selling to. And then second of all, 15% of people who come to my website are because they found us in a store. It's just free. It's complete. It's free marketing, right? And so anyone who tells me they don't want to be in wholesale, I think is crazy. Unless they don't have their margins set up correctly. And you need to know that from the beginning or change your pricing.
Wholesale is a step that happens after a certain amount of success going directly to the consumer. Is that right? So that you have the numbers to show.
I mean, I think so. Unless you can find, there's some other channels out there. There's Fair, there's Tundra. Where you can put your product onto those particular sites, and people, if you're set up nicely, it's essentially, like e-commerce, but for wholesalers, right? And they can purchase them there. They offer them terms on there. There's some really, really cool things, that you can do. That's where I would start right away, is go to Fair, or Tundra, and start selling your products there. I wouldn't recommend doing it do it in tandem, right? Build that business in tandem together. You may not be as nearly as profitable on the wholesale side, but it's very important as a brand to be in stores.
It's like you said, the amount of customers that's acquiring you, and then you're getting those repeat orders that, you know, it's going to add up to more than just that initial sale, even if the profit margin's low.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So between Facebook ads, YouTube ads, any others that you run, what is your favorite? Where's your favorite place to run ads?
It really depends for what reason, right? So acquisition, Facebook, even with iOS 14 and 14.5 coming out recently, it's still the best place to acquire new customers. As far as retargeting, my favorite placement is YouTube. If I love running brand story videos on YouTube, to retargeting audiences, right? So anybody who's come to our site, you know, in the past 30 days, I want to hit them with our brand story. And it's incredible to see the view through rate, of those. The one thing that you need to know with YouTube, and I'm sure you've had experts on here before about YouTube, is not to take, click through data, right? YouTube is a branding play. It is the TV of 2021. Right? The TV ad of 2021, just way, the targeting is just incredible, right? The cost per thousand impressions is insanely low for what it should be, right? On YouTube. So I love that for any retargeting audiences. YouTube is amazing. Another great top of funnel that hardly anybody is using is Snapchat. I got turned back onto Snapchat recently, and we are getting 6 cent swipe ups on Snapchat to cold audiences. Yeah. 6 cents. Those people are eventually converting as well. Like they're going into our retargeting audiences across all platforms.
Are these Snapchat ads, so they're 9x16, do they look like an Instagram story ad?
So exactly. Anything you're going to do for an Instagram story ad, you can do over on Snapchat. They also now have some really great e-commerce functionality on Snapchat. So you can run dynamic product ads on Snapchat, and that's mostly what we're doing. It's very, very simple. But if you have great creative, the better your creative on any platform, the better your results are going to be.
So with Snapchat, does it have some kind of like pixel or anything like that of means of tracking, or only if they then go over to your website and then you track them on your website? Like, does it?
No, it's got all the same types of tracking functionality that Facebook does. Obviously, they're, you know, behind the curve. Comparatively to Facebook. But yeah, it's got all of the same types of, you can create lookalike audiences based off of engagement, based off of website visitors. You can create interest audiences. It's got all of that same sort of functionality built into it.
It probably just doesn't work as well just because they don't have as much data on people.
Exactly. I mean, I think the field is being leveled right now. So I think that those other platforms are going to be very interesting to get into. TikTok is another huge one that we're watching right now. We're seeing incredible results with TikTok. But again, you got to remember that whatever you're doing, you're not going to create YouTube style videos for TikTok. You're going to create TikTok videos for TikTok, right? It's a different platform.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. You're probably not even using those Instagram story ads over there, right? They're made specifically for TikTok.
They have to be TikTok style videos or you will not succeed on the platform, right?
Anytime. Yeah, tell me about the one that's working best for you. Like, this is hard marketing because you really got to blend in organically. Like, they can't distinguish this as an ad, I feel like, when they swipe and see your
Absolutely.
post on TikTok.
So the ones that work the best are working with, if you're working with TikTok influencers, is moving those TikTok influencers using their content for TikTok ads, right? So whitelisting their profiles and using that for your ads will always beat out anyone. And it's the same on Facebook. It's this little known secret that I just don't really see anyone using. I see big brands using it. HelloFresh does an awesome job with this, but using their influencers' profiles to advertise, right? You can run your ads through your influencers' profiles. We call it here at Mindful Marketing, we call it SPA marketing, social proof acceleration. Whitelisting is another version of that. We're trying to get away from the whitewashing everything. So we wanted to create a different term for it. But, that's really, really, impactful.
What's the setup like for that? When someone wants to team up with an influencer to run ads from their account, I feel like the general person is going to think, well, do I have to teach them how to run ads, or like, how do we do this? Are they going to set it up, or how do I get access to their account to run that? Or can you tell us just a little bit about the technical side of setting that up?
I'll tell it to you on Facebook. On TikTok, you have to have an actual account rep to be able to do that. So you cannot do that yourself on TikTok, unfortunately.
Okay.
But on Facebook, it's and Instagram, it's very simple. You just get access to their page. You just request access. If you just want to use their page, it's super simple. If you want to get use of their audiences, that's a little bit harder. Then you actually have to get permission from their business manager. Then you have to share those audiences over to your business manager. And then you can use those audiences. So it's really great. I mean, I recommend trying to get use of those audiences, because say they have 300,000 followers. You can target those 300,000 followers with your page or their page. So there's some really cool stuff that you can do in there as well.
Got it. Yeah, especially so you're taking – you might get their pixel data or not their pixel data because it's coming from their Instagram platform, right?
That's
you're just
right.
creating like a custom audience of people who have engaged with their page.
That's right. Yes, yes. So you can get their engagement audiences.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you can layer that with interests. Like
yes.
they have to be someone who recently engaged with them and interested in this. And
totally.
This.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay, cool. Fun stuff. Yeah, I've seen HelloFresh do that with a lot of like the people who are on The Bachelor, especially is like who they always get to be their influencers.
Yeah, but they do a great job of it.
An actual sponsored. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
They're all like lining up. It's like a thing like, oh yeah, if you're on The Bachelor, you're just, that's the next step is HelloFresh.
<That's>
but
funny.
Yeah, I see. I know what you're talking about, seeing the sponsored ads coming from them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, what do you think? So the iOS 14 update, you said it still is your go-to platform for having the best targeting and capabilities and everything like that. What do you feel like people do need to keep in mind with the iOS 14 update? Because it obviously will have some impact.
You just have to get better. That's as a marketer and as a brand owner, you just have to get better. Your creative has to be better. You've got to know the big things now. It's old school, right? You got to go back and look at landing page views, right? Cost per landing page view. That's a huge one. Are your ads actually doing well? Are they resonating with the audience? And that's going to start at that point and top of the funnel, right? So it's really going back to the basics. The brands that we see, like, you know, some of the clients that we have spending hundreds of thousands of dollars a month, are not having a problem because they have great creative that we've created for them. They have, great, offers. They have just an awesome product. None of that will change, right? None of that changes. It's just the targeting. It's just targeting has always been, the bottom of the barrel for me. When I'm looking at stuff, I'm like, it's targeting is not the magic, right? The magic is the marketing, is the offer, the creative, the ad copy. That's like, if you don't have those down, you're not going to be able to sell anything anyway, right? You could even like, you could be putting it in front of the perfect person and it doesn't matter.
I've heard. People take both stances here on targeting of either saying it's the least important thing or it's the most important thing. And I can see both, right? Like people will say like, well, if you're advertising, you know, men's clothing and they're not even a man, you know, then obviously the targeting matters. So like, it's not even, you know, that's not the best example, but you know what I mean? But just putting in front of someone who could possibly buy it as the first thing, do you just, you feel like that as long as you have basic targeting down, you're going to be putting it in front of a potential customer and then it's all about your advertising from there? Or
I mean, I wouldn't even, I'd almost disagree with that even, right? Like okay. You can run these open audiences on Facebook that perform better than these closed audiences, right? Because Facebook knows people that well and they know what they're still interested in. Even with iOS 14, you can still, their algorithm is still absolutely unreal. I still like narrowing targeting down. But still, we're talking minimum audiences in the States of like 3 million, minimum in Canada of like 1 million, Australia, similar, like about a million. So these are pretty broad audiences. The one thing that we're noticing that interest audiences are doing a lot better right now and open audiences, than lookalikes. And I think Facebook's just a little bit confused, their algorithm right now with, the purchase data because it's not getting fed through the same sort of way that it was to create lookalikes.
I hear a lot of people say, even if you have a brand new Facebook pixel, if you're trying to sell a product, you start with a conversions for purchase campaign, not a traffic landing page views campaign. What's your take on it?
Yeah, great.
Even with what you just said.
Great advice. I mean, it seems like, yes, we should first start trying to get people to the website, right? To like, people call it like peppering the pixel. Totally not true. Totally not true. You're telling Facebook to find you people who click on links and land on pages. That's what you're telling Facebook. Hey, this is what I want. Those people aren't necessarily going to convert. You want to tell Facebook, I want purchasers, right? Those are the people I want. Do I want people who initiate checkout or add to cart? No. Like, I do not want those people. I want people who are going to purchase. So yes, you're totally right on with that, Derek.
I think where people, then they run into the issue of they're not putting enough ad budget into exit the learning phase because they're not getting enough purchases. Right?
Yeah, so like, absolutely.
They're running $30 a day, $50 a day even. But you still need a decent amount of purchases before it actually exits the learning phase. So is, what would you say there is, what's the solution? Just put in a lot of ad budget when you're going to do it and just know it's going to cost a lot to actually figure out the data correctly, or just let your Facebook pixel say learning limited for a little bit and just let it drag on at whatever budget you can afford.
I just start turning ad sets off within a CBO campaign. That's really what it comes down to, is just like get rid of the other ad sets. If you don't have enough budget to be able to move around, then just start getting rid of the ones that are underperforming. Don't let them continue to try to perform, so that you can get out of that learning limited as soon as possible. And then into learning and then hopefully into active. And then that's where you can really start scaling these campaigns up, you know, 20% budgets a day. We have a lot of rules that we use at our agency for those types of scaling.
What's your rule for minimum ad budget per ad set?
I mean, we rarely, only in retargeting do we ever use ad set budget optimization. CBO is still so much more powerful. Yeah,
I hear so many mixed things on that too. People say like, just don't do the CBO so that you have just more control.
Yeah, I mean,
is it again just letting Facebook have, you've just learned to let Facebook have the power?
Yeah, I trust Facebook a lot more than I trust me. So, when it comes to that and to the things that I can't control. So sure, you can continue to run ad set budget optimization. We do that in large accounts sometimes where we'll run some ABO campaigns, but it's still CBO is still winning. In every single account that we use for cold audiences, CBO will always, it's just gotten so good. Maybe there's a little blip right now with 14.5, but it's really still the way to go.
Are you ever clicking automatic placements?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
I'm like, you're clicking all of the other Facebook recommended things.
No.
And, not that one. Okay.
And also another huge no-no within Facebook is opening up, you know, if you're going to target interest and then say all like an opening up interest after that. No. These are all very basic things that we do not do.
Yeah. And for those of you listening to the show that are brand new with Facebook ads and don't know what we've been talking about, I always do a recap episode. I think I'm going to do like an intro to Facebook ad terms as like my next one, because a lot of people are brand new to the ads here on the show. So it all makes sense. But so what you're saying right there is don't click detailed targeting expansion, correct?
Exactly. Thank you. I'm hitting that wall right now where I can't think of terms.
You're just like, just uncheck the box below the placements area. Okay, so we'll talk about that on the next episode. But yeah, that just makes it so you have no idea where your data is actually coming from. It could be from the interest that you set or whatever else they chose. So you never really know how to tweak your ads from there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So give us a little bit more here on we've got a lot of brand new business owners who want to start doing Facebook ads, or maybe they've done like promoting posts, you know, stuff like that. So not really Facebook ads. They've just given Facebook some money for some likes kind of deal.
Yeah.
They want to head over. They set up a purchase conversions campaign. I usually say that it's going to be really difficult to even for this thing to even work unless you also have retargeting set up and such like that. What is the minimum amount of like what's the macroscopic ad structure look like to the campaign that is like the minimum you'd recommend someone have set up before they try it? Like, because would you recommend someone just try a $20 purchase campaign and just throw money at and see if what happens with no retargeting, or do they need to have retargeting, and what are the minimums that someone should have before they start giving Facebook money?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say $100 a day is a really good minimum amount to set up a funnel that's actually going to work, right? So you need to have your retargeting and retention in one ad set, or sorry, in one campaign. And maybe you could throw your engagement audience in there as well, but I usually will have retargeting retention together. With a smaller ad account, right? So retargeting retention, we'll have engagement acquisition, and then we'll have all of our acquisition audiences in one campaign with a small budget like that. So three separate campaigns for the funnel. It's that simple at the beginning, and then you can get more and more complicated as your budget goes up and up and up.
Okay. And do you start with? Do you do this thing where you do single interest, like 10? Like a lot of people do 10 different ad sets, one interest per ad set, and then start narrowing it down. Do you have like a pretty strict guidelines for how many ad sets you start off with?
I mean, I only ever recommend 5 per campaign, especially if you're running CBO. So we run campaign budget optimization, so 5 is max that I'm ever going to run. Sure, if you're running ad set budget optimization, you can run it like that with an interest per to see if that's what's going to work. I'd just be very careful when you're split testing. Don't split test multiple things, right? So if you're going to run different interests per campaign, per ad set, make sure your ads are the exact same, right? So you're feeding the exact same data through. You're going to have a bunch of audience overlap though, right? If you're running those a single interest. And then that's where things get dicey with Facebook, right? So really try, like in 2021, you've got to try to aggregate your audiences together a little bit more. Facebook really likes that, and they don't like audience overlap. You really will get like penalized, not because they don't like you. It's just that the algorithm doesn't know what to do when you're overlapping your audiences between ad sets so much. So that's the problem with doing one interest per audience, is that there's going to be a lot of overlapping interests between there. Like in the outdoor space, you know, if I did hiking as one interest and biking as another interest, I'm going to have massive overlap between those two. So I'll probably put those two together, right? So put interests together in an ad set, and you're going to get a lot more love from Facebook.
Using a narrow further, like audience, and then narrow further with another audience? Are you
No, I'm talking about combining those interests together, right? And making sure that your overlap isn't in that like million person sort of range, right? Between your ad sets. Because then it's really confusing, especially with campaign budget optimization.
Okay. So you were saying too that you're grouping all of your retargeting into one audience. Did I hear that correctly?
No, into one campaign, and then running. I run lots of those CBO. I run those retargeting campaigns as CBO campaigns.
Makes sense. Yeah. Okay. And with those ones, are you doing conversions purchases, or because they're a retargeting audience, are you using traffic just because they are already by default qualified?
No, I'm still running them as purchase conversion campaigns. That still seemed to, we split tested that lots, and it doesn't seem to be getting better results. You know, we used to do the old trick where you'd, you know, try for reach. It just doesn't work anymore. Facebook's way better at finding those people than we are. Yeah, there's no more, you just can't trick the platform like you used to be able to. You know, there used to be all these little tricks and stuff. I'm not into that anyway. Like, anytime any of that stuff comes around, like Bitcoin, you know, for instance, right? Everyone's all hot on Bitcoin. I'm like, I just don't care. I can't get caught up in every shiny thing that comes around, whether it's maybe going to be good or not. Slow and steady is really how you build an incredible business and how you build wealth.
Just stay into what you know, and you're like, this makes money. I know what I'm doing, and
yeah,
just getting better at that. Don't need to learn every new thing that comes around.
Totally.
Okay. Okay. Cool, man. Yeah, lots of great stuff. I know what you mean. Just with all those little tricks to try to get your costs down, and I like hearing them because I always love the theory behind them or like what their idea behind it is. But basically, what I've heard of, you know, doing the reach campaign for retargeting is like, yeah, they already clicked on your website. We don't need to tell Facebook to optimize for purchase conversions because they like already, you know, are coming from an optimized purchase conversion campaign and already went to the website. But you found that it still is better to do a purchase conversions campaign for your retargeting. Even
we split tested it extensively. I mean, we have most of the businesses that we run that we own have hundreds of thousands of people in their retargeting audiences. So like, I'm not going to that just doesn't make any sense to optimize for reach on those. For little businesses that have very little, sure, you can try that if you want, but I'm telling you, like, we've split tested this a lot, and telling Facebook that you want that purchase out of them is a lot better because it's going to then show potentially 5 to 10 times to that person that they think is going to convert. Whereas if you're just going off of impressions or reach, it's not going to do that.
Got it. Yeah. It's like, we already showed it to them today. They liked it and we moved on, you know, cause they don't know they're going for that purchase. Exactly. They don't know they need to keep hammering in on that person until they buy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. Cool, such great questions, Derek.
Okay. Well, yeah, I always ask like, this is info I need. So hopefully it resonates with you guys out there. But yeah, I run lots of Facebook ad campaigns for a lot of different mostly e-commerce brands, and they're usually newer. I don't work with a ton of these bigger brands that you're working with. I usually work with people on their, one of their first, if not the first Facebook ad campaign is more what I specialize in.
Okay.
Helping people start there. So
yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is a big difference. I just want to let everybody know, like, there is a big difference between running scaled campaigns to 7 and 8 figure businesses versus ones that when you're just starting out, there is a big difference.
So yeah, as we're wrapping up here, man, just what would you say about the e-commerce market in general, going forward here? If people are wanting to get started in entrepreneurship, is this one of the best new businesses for someone to start, or what would you recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is really, we're just getting started in e-com, right? This would be like opening up a shop in the 1930s or something, you know? There is only up from here. It's still such a tiny sliver of the total retail landscape, that e-com is really an incredible place to get into with some caveats. You need to create a brand. If you're just out there to sell products, no one's going to buy your business, first of all. If you want to exit one day because it's just a product. I never look at just single product businesses. That's never in something that I look at. So building a brand is really, really important. And then just treating your customers incredibly well and, doing whatever you can to retain those customers.
Any other thing that you'd recommend for how they select that market? Is this something that they should be passionate in? Do you see a lot of people fall off that try to, makeup's a good market profit margin wise, but it's not what I care about. What do you think about that? Do you think people can start a business that they just see good numbers in, or do they have to have the passion for it?
I personally think that they need to be able to see themselves in the customer, in the target demographic, or else they're not going to have the passion to continue it on. Yeah, that's really what it comes down to. I mean, people will tell you different things. I think personally for me, that's what's really helped over the years. I am passionate. I mean, the reason why we still have the agency and continue to grow the agency is because I am my customer, right? I love helping people grow and be profitable, and because it really changes their life, right, in the end. So I really do believe that you need to have some sort of connection to your target demographic.
It makes it a lot easier. I've learned the hard way on that one. I'll expand on that on the next episode too, choosing a niche that looks great, but you also don't care about it at all. It makes it really hard to write the ads properly.
Totally.
Get into the minds of the customer. I did make myself immersed in that market though, but it was very forced. You know, I went out and I bought like everything as if I was a hobbyist and tried to get into it, but it was still really, it makes it hard to do for years on end. Right?
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Jordan, this has been a great interview, man. Where can people find you?
Yeah, totally. So if you want to connect, I'm very active on LinkedIn. So if you search for Jordan West Marketer on LinkedIn. And then also if you want to learn more about what we do with 7 and 8 figure brands at Mindful Marketing, you can just go to mindfulmarketing.co.
And are you on Instagram?
We are on Instagram. You could just search Mindful Marketing there or Jordan T. West.
Mindful Marketing.
Yeah. Yeah, those are a couple places, but I am not super active on Instagram.
Okay. I tried to find you on Instagram before by just typing in Jordan West, but there's a lot of options.
Yeah.
I didn't know where to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. So your website is a better place to contact you. And
totally.
Of course, your podcast, I'm sure plenty of people will be interested in that.
Yes. Secrets to Scaling Your E-commerce Brand. And I'm looking forward to having you on, Derek.
Yeah. I think within the next couple of weeks, I'll be on your podcast.
Awesome.
So that'll be fun.
Great.
Cool, man. Well, thanks so much. You have a great rest of your day.
You too. See ya.